Both the U.S. and Russia have escalated their rhetoric over claims of indiscriminate attacks on civilians in Syria. The World Health Organization is estimating about 500 people in Syria have symptoms similar to people exposed to toxic chemicals. The attack on the Damascus suburb of Douma happened Saturday. Syrian government forces are preventing access to Douma for journalists, aid workers, and investigators. And the latest tweets from President Trump on Syria raise the possibility of open military conflict. We're talking about the humanitarian situation in Syria on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let us bring in David Michael Crane, who is started the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. He's editor of the new book, The Founders, Four Pioneering Individuals Who Launched the First Modern Era International Criminal Tribunals. He was the founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. That's an international war crimes tribunal established by the UN and the government of Sierra Leone to prosecute people who had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Sierra Leone's civil war in the 1990s. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate.
So take us to what aid workers are up against in Syria. What are living conditions like there? What is the humanitarian aid relief looking like there right now?
Well, you know, if you've seen any of the Mad Max Thunderdome movies, Syria has devolved literally into this Mad Max Thunderdome apocalyptic scenario where all persons are just subject to random attacks by various combatants, to include the Syrian regime and Russian forces. The humanitarian workers are facing incredible odds, but their bravery has saved thousands of lives. But at the end of the day, they are also targets. You know, the famous white helmets that go in and try to save people after a bombardment and stuff, they're randomly picked off by snipers and what have you, which is absolutely against international law, the laws of armed conflict, international humanitarian law. You know, you can never intentionally target civilians, and that has certainly been a major, major issue in almost my 8 years of working on this tragedy.
The State Department is reporting that since 2012, the U.S. has provided nearly $7.7 billion for humanitarian aid to Syria, that money paying for food, shelter, drinking water, medical care, the list goes on. In the fiscal year 2017, the annual amount the U.S. contributed fell to $1.5 billion. Is America sending enough aid to support the Syrian people?
Well, again, that's hard to quantify. Any help is important. And yes, even though the numbers seem to be declining, I think the U.S. With a new administration is showing less interest, almost ceding the authority of and the influence of Russia, which is something that we've never done before. So it appears that we're wandering away. Now, granted, the Trump administration is threatening some type of retaliatory strike based on another chemical attack. But again, it appears that the U.S. Is stepping away from Syria.
And a little bit more in these numbers, the U.N. Refugee Agency is reporting that the world has more than 22 million refugees. And in the past 5 months, the U.S. has admitted 11 Syrian refugees. And that's a sharp contrast to the time under President Obama when thousands of Syrian refugees came here. The pace of refugee admissions is set to hit a record low this year. What accounts for this, and what is the U.S. doing on the refugee front?
Well, again, it's in these situations, it's all about a political policy, and the political policy of the United States at this point is to turn away refugees throughout the world. Unfortunately, Syria is paying the price as well. You know, you bring up refugees, Kate. I mean, this is an amazing situation. Granted, we've had over 500,000 people killed but there are almost 12 million refugees. That's like all of New England, to include New York, fleeing New England into Ohio, West Virginia, and Virginia as their homes burn and are destroyed in that part of the world. I mean, it's a staggering amount of displacement as a result of this civil war. And so refugees are looking for any place to try to rebuild their lives.
Is the crisis that we're seeing in Syria comparable to humanitarian crises that you've seen in the past? I mean, you've seen what happened in Sierra Leone and elsewhere. We see humanitarian, situations around the world. So how does Syria factor into that, and how does it compare?
Well, you know, Syria is a conflict. We have over 13 different types of organizations involved. Most of them, if not all of them, are ignoring international humanitarian law. Because of that, civilians are paying a particular price in that, and it's typical in what I call the dirty little wars of the 21st century, that civilians are paying a price. So this is, even though none of these are actually in a cookie-cutter way the same, it is typical in a civil strife, civil war. Civilians are paying the price, and you see that not just in Syria. We're certainly seeing in Yemen, which we're starting to get involved in as well, and we're seeing it within Myanmar and in South Sudan, et cetera, et cetera. So sadly, civilians are paying a very, very ugly price in these kaleidoscopic, dirty little wars of the 21st century.
We're talking with David Michael Crane. He is a law professor at Syracuse University. He created the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a healthcare provider who's worked in crisis? How does civil strife change the way you take care of people? What is it like to treat the body and the mind under war conditions? Have you gone overseas as a missionary or as part of a service organization? Maybe you've been in Syria to provide aid or in another country during conflict. What's your story and what sticks out with you? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. David, describe for us what the effort is behind the Syrian Accountability Project.
In March of 2011, when the civil strife started, by a group of children in Daraa, I was asked by the Syrian National Congress to come and meet them in the Netherlands, in The Hague, to talk to them about justice mechanisms for a possible trial in the summer of 2011, which I did meet with them and gave them the options. And from there, I realized that we need to start documenting. And so, based on what I did in West Africa, taking down Charles Taylor and his henchmen, I began to create a conflict map, a crime-based matrix, began to draft sample indictments and other side issues related to the conflict. And we have been doing that since March of 2011. We've just ended our eighth year. We have a crime-based matrix, the largest in the world. We have over 9,000 pages of verified incidents that could rise to a international crime. So, we continue to do our work. We do have a solid base. We share our work with our clients, the International Criminal Court, the United Nations, and various countries, and we continue to do that on a quarterly basis. So that was the basis of the Syrian Accountability Project, and we're now turning our eyes towards Yemen as well.
And so when you say a crime-based matrix, what do you mean by that?
Well, that's a great question. What we do is we have an incident. We put the date, time, the location, the alleged perpetrators, and other ancillary information. And then we also list specific violation of the Rome Statute from the International Criminal Court, the international humanitarian law, aspects of that, the Geneva Conventions, and we've translated the Syrian criminal code into English, and so we also specifically cite the violation of the Syrian criminal code in that specific allegation. It's on an, excuse me, it's on an Excel spreadsheet, and there's 25 incidents per page, and we have about 9,000 pages now.
We're talking right now with David Michael Crane. He is from Syracuse University, created the Syrian Accountability Project, documenting crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Perhaps you've gone overseas as a missionary or as part of an aid organization. Maybe you've been in Syria. What is your story? What sticks out to you? What are you doing to help the situation in Syria? Join in the conversation. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. The UN Refugee Agency is reporting that tens of thousands of civilians remain trapped in eastern Ghouta. That's a suburb of the Syrian capital, Damascus. It's estimated that more than 133,000 people have fled eastern Ghouta over the past 4 weeks. This is happening as the U.S. weighs how to respond to the suspected chemical attacks. Talking about the situation on the ground and the humanitarian crisis on the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. David Michael Crane stays with us. He's a law professor at Syracuse University. He created the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. He was founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, an international war crimes tribunal that was established by the UN in the 90s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think about the people of Syria? Who should we label an enemy? Is there a difference between military and civilians? And what comes to mind when you see the images of the attacks on Syrian families? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. David, can you give us a sense of the extent of the displacement? What percentage of the population has been forced to leave the country, and what we know about the people left behind?
Well, again, the refugee challenge is just amazing. Even though we've had the tragedy of over 500,000 people killed, and you know, when I started this project into our eighth year, but 8 years ago, the number who had been killed were just dozens, and now we're over 500,000. But the tragedy here is that we have over 12 million Syrian refugees on the move, fleeing Syria, trying to survive this apocalyptic horror that's going on in Syria. The percentages are rating up to 25-30%. Whole areas of Syria are vacant. The refugee camps in and around Syria are becoming major cities in the city where they have fled. This is just indicative of the dirty little war that has evolved into Syria.
And we have reports this morning that the Syrian government forces have raised their flag in Douma. It was previously that the biggest rebel-held stronghold near Damascus, and now the area is in shambles. How does that back and forth between government forces and insurgents affect the instability Syrians are trying to deal with right now?
Well, everybody's killing everybody now. When we first started our work in Syria, we had a pretty... it was very easy to figure out who the good guys and bad guys are. It was the Syrian army versus the Free Syrian Army for about the first year. But then other groups began to insert themselves, and then the war became very, very personal. And this is where we see a real uptick in the civilian deaths and the war crimes being committed by all sides in this tragedy.
Let's bring in a call now. John is joining us with a question from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. In part, I think you just answered it. It was two parts, really. The first was you'd indicated earlier that your spreadsheet contains alleged crimes, and so I'm just curious what work is done in an attempt to corroborate, you know, if in fact those happened. And the second part was, you know, there are a lot of geopolitical, ethnic, and religious forces at play in that region and in the country. And what do you do to try and ferret out who is responsible?
Great questions, John. Yeah,
it is a great question, John. And, well, again, you know, Syria, for the past 3,000 years in our history, is the crossroads to three continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa. And ethnic groups and various other types of groups have been moving through and living in that part of the world called the Levant. And it's still the same today. And we have so many different kind of groups in the conflict. We have Alawites, Christians, Sunni, Shia. We have various other cultural groups. We have Kurds moving about. We have Christians, all of which are trying to establish some type of security. What's happened, John, in Syria now is that we have occupied areas of these various groups, and the Islamic Republic of Syria, which is the legal name and one of which is represented in the United Nations, where Assad is head of state, you know, he only controls about 25% of the country in some form or another. So it's a very, very kaleidoscopic situation that changes daily.
Do we know what the situation is and where Assad is now? Is Bashar al-Assad in Syria right now, or in a palace somewhere? And where is he?
Well, again, no, I have no reason to believe he has moved anywhere else other than where he is. His seat of government is, and that is the capital of Damascus, and he is in his palace there. I'm sure he has various kinds of security and a secured bunker, but he hasn't moved.
What about the suspected chemical weapons used in Saturday's attack? We're hearing dozens of reported dead after they suffocated. Rescue workers in Syria say at least 42 people died, some with white foam coming from their mouths and noses, others with burning eyes, breathing issues. Why is that so startling to the international community?
Well, I think that's a very, very important question, and one we really have to think about today. You know, the use of any type of chemical weapon is absolutely prohibited under international law. Just the use of it itself is illegal per se. We have rarely seen the use of chemical weapons in conflict. We saw it introduced in World War I, and the world recoiled in horror at the results of was largely mustard and chlorine gas. Chemical Weapons Convention was put together, which banned all uses of such type of weapons. And so we have not seen, and we did not even see it at all in the horror of World War II. Granted, the Nazis used gas to kill Jews and others, but as a weapon system in combat, it was not used at all. And rarely have we seen in the modern era the use of chemicals. We saw Saddam Hussein used it against the Kurds in the Anfal region in the 80s, but that was and also against the Iranians during the Iranian-Iraqi conflict. But that was it until we see it used twice in Syria, and that's a terrible slippery slope that we're seeing. There's absolutely no reason to use it. It's absolutely prohibited, but yet all of a sudden, within 2 years, we've seen it used. Why, or 1 year, we've seen it used twice, and I'm very, very concerned about that. It looks like they're using a sarin-type gas as well as a variation of chlorine gas as well. And again, absolutely prohibited, a war crime and a crime against humanity.
So if the Syrian government forces are preventing access to Douma, where these suspected chemical attacks occurred, and they're preventing access for aid workers, investigators, journalists, how can your crime matrix stay up to date and be able to figure out what has absolutely happened if they cover it up?
Well, again, you know, it's not a perfect system that we have. We have a very strict standard. We only use verified incidents that we record. You know, we have our both open source methodologies as well as our covert and clandestine sources with our agents in place. The sad thing is, you know, we've over the past 7+ years, you know, we've lost about half of our persons on the ground due to the conflict. But you know, we have to wait. You know, it's not like we have to record it immediately, but we do it as soon as we can. But you know, it is a challenge. But I want to make a footnote here. You know, the prohibition of aid workers to help civilians based on a conflict is also a violation of the Geneva Conventions and a war crime. So it's just every day a constant stream of violations of international law every day in Syria.
So when you say that you have lost people on the project, lost on the ground there over the last 7 years, can you elaborate on that?
They just disappear. We never hear from them again. And, you know, we can't go in and try to verify that, but we're just losing assets. You know, we have a very close association with various Syrian human rights groups that also provide us this information, and some of these people work for them. It's a tragedy. These people have given their lives to report the horror story, and, you know, they should never be ignored and should be honored. But yeah, that's what's happened. So it's becoming more and more of a challenge as the events begin to become more gruesome.
We're looking at the humanitarian impact this hour of the morning show. David Crane is here. He created the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about civilians in Syria? How do you think about the people of Syria? Who should we label as an enemy? Is there a difference between military and civilians? And what comes to mind when you see the images of Saturday's attack on Syrian families? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to John waiting for us in Boaz. Hi, John.
Hi. My grandfather fought the Russians 100 years ago. I want to ask our guest, David, what is Russia's hand in supplying these chemicals? Because ultimately the Russians are needing a port, a naval port to the south. They want to build a naval port to the south, and they'll be exploiting the poor country of Syria until they get this. We don't want to hit their civilians with our bombs.
John, thank you. So Russia and Iran are Syrian allies. Where do they fit into this picture?
Well, again, Russia is very, very complicit, is committing war crimes on a daily basis. The chemical weapons are coming from, we believe, Russia itself, if not the Iranians, who are also very much in cahoots with the Russians. The Russians have had a close geopolitical association with Syria since the Cold War. Syria was very much part of the Warsaw Pact, so to speak. They looked to Russia for their support in the craziness of the Cold War. And yeah, Russia, you're very right, John. They need a warm water port. And so they actually do have one and have had one for decades, and they'll continue to be there. But that's what Russia wants to do, is to continue to maintain or build up its influence in that part of the world, which they really have had very little influence with the Middle East. But in Syria, they've always had a great deal of influence. So it's a political move, geopolitical move by Putin to reassert Russian dominance in Syria and have some kind of status within the Middle East. And this is why they're very much in Syria, to do that, but also to make sure that they keep that warm water port on the Mediterranean.
Let's bring in Marty now with a question. Marty in Elkhorn. Hi there.
Good morning. Excuse me. You know, why hasn't a mercenary been enlisted to take out Assad? With so many players in this ongoing battle right now, wouldn't it be easy to, you know, pull this off and unknown?
Yeah, and Marty, you're fading out there, but essentially you're asking, would taking out Bashar al-Assad out of power by any means improve the situation for the Syrian people?
You know, it's interesting. When I went to The Hague back in March of 2011, That was precisely what they wanted to do, was to kill Assad. And, of course, you know, that is to be respected, the point of view as to, why don't we just take the guy out? And that's the what appears to be the easy way. And up through the 20th century, before we established modern international criminal law, that did happen. But again, I think it's important for accountability purposes that Assad eventually, and he will be, held accountable for what he's done to his own people. As you may or may not know, there is no statute of limitations on war crimes and crimes against humanity and other international crimes. So, you know, whether he is 5 years, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we still can create a justice mechanism to hold him accountable. I'll just give you a good example. Charles Taylor, President Charles Taylor of Liberia, the person who I took down, and who is responsible for what we call the West African Joint Criminal Enterprise, or you might have heard it as the Blood Diamond story. You know, he never thought just 12 years ago that he would be held accountable for the aiding and abetting of the destruction of over 1.2 million human beings. Yet now he sits in a maximum security prison in Her Majesty's prison system in England for the rest of his life. So it sometimes takes time. It is a natural human reaction, is why don't we just take the guy out and move on. But the implications for humanity itself are dire. We'd rather use the law, not the gun. And one of the things that I, in the 20 years I've been involved in this, is I've always been telling people the rule of law is more powerful than the rule of the gun.
David, let's look a little bit closer, though, with that. You have confidence that Assad and the Assad regime will one day go to The Hague?
Well, no, it's not The Hague. I mean, it's important for our listeners to understand. Justice mechanisms can be essentially in four areas. We can have a domestic court, a Syrian court, prosecuting Syrians in violation of Syrian law.
Mm-hmm.
We can also have what we call an internationalized domestic court, where the same thing, but we have internationals come in and assist them in trying those individuals for violations of both international as well as domestic law. We also have the possibility of maybe a regional court put together by Arab states to do the same thing. And then we, of course, have the possibility of an international tribunal to do the same thing as well. And again, there's no statute of limitations. So right now, the geopolitics of it all, Assad is essentially winning militarily the civil war, but that does not absolve him. Winning does not absolve anybody of anything other than they've just happened to be in power at the time. But, you know, I think that there may be a geopolitical moment. It may be 5-10 years from now where in fact, Assad, his henchmen, and all others within the Syrian conflict will be held accountable. I'd rather look at it that way. That's why we continue our work. We have to do our work because, again, the people of Syria demand justice. And just to riff off the last question, you know, the people of Syria want to see accountability. They just don't want to just, in fact, see the individual killed. There's many, many others, and no country can move forward peacefully if they revert to vigilante justice. You need the law in order to create a pathway by which a country can emerge from a horror story like Syria.
We're looking at the humanitarian impact this hour of the morning show with David Crane. He created the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. He is a law professor at Syracuse University. You can join in the conversation. We'll be back after a news update here on the Ideas Network. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has repeatedly denied using chemical weapons, calling the claims a pretext for a military attack. What do we know is that more than 133,000 people have fled a suburb of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The UN Refugee Agency reported Tuesday on an alarming humanitarian crisis in eastern Ghouta. Talking about humanitarian relief efforts, the law, the risks on the morning show, I'm Kedar Chirkent. David Crane stays with us. He created the Syrian Accountability Project to document crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Have you spent time in the armed forces. How does your service influence the way you think about what's happening in Syria? Do you see military risks? Is the U.S. making the right call in Syria? What about the suspected chemical attacks? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. David, I think the most heart-wrenching images are the children. We see a lot of children who are victims of the Syrian civil war in the media. Why is that? And can you explain the impact this war has had on Syrian children? David, are you there? Oh, we seem to have momentarily lost David Crane here. Let's take another call now. Let's go to Mark in Franklin. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think this whole situation is terrible, and I think we've caused most of it. We had a dictator in Syria, yes, but since we decided to throw him out along with the Arab Spring that we totally destabilized the entire Middle East, things have gotten so bad for those people there, and it's spread to Europe with the refugee crisis that's going on there. I think the last right thing that we did in the Middle East was driving Iran out of Iraq, and we should have stopped there once we started destabilizing the dictatorships and not having something to put in for them. We've just made the situation from bad to worse to terrible, and the only people that are left in Syria are the ones that couldn't afford to get out in the last 5 years.
So, Mark, you're seeing this power vacuum, if you will, and a destabilization of the whole region and the dominoes there. David, what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, again, excellent thoughts. Let me just back up just a little bit. You know, the United Nations was created to maintain and restore international peace and security. And that has happened all the way up through through Syria largely. And all of a sudden, we're seeing in these dirty little kaleidoscopic wars of the 21st century situations where we may not be able to restore international peace and security and only be able to manage that. It's very much like a type of cancer which is not life-threatening but has to be managed. And if it is not contained, perhaps it will move throughout the rest of the body. Syria is the very same thing in a sense. If we don't contain Syria, manage some type of stability in some form or another, it will destabilize. It already has, frankly, but it'll destabilize more the region, and we can slip into a regional or a world war very, very quickly. So this instability that's created by this civil war, we aren't really sure where this is all going to end up. But it's my opinion that Syria will take decades to recover from this. And because of that, it will be a destabilized part of the world where the United Nations can only manage international peace and security as opposed to restore it.
Mark, thank you for the call. David, when we momentarily lost you there, I was asking about children in this conflict. We see so many images of children who are victims of the civil war in the media. Why is that, and what is the impact that this war has had on the children of Syria?
Having been in this business for a long time, and I've seen horrors beyond description, I always go after individuals who prey on women and children, and that happened in West Africa with the child soldier phenomenon. And intentionally killing civilians is an absolute prohibition under international law. But to see the deaths of children, it builds up a sense of righteous fury in those of us who are trying to seek justice for victims of atrocity. So, why do I do this every day? It's for the likes of the children that we see that are suffering so greatly. The impact on this generation of children who cannot go to school, who are traumatized by atrocity, will be far-reaching and lifelong. And we really don't fully appreciate where this is going to go as far as their lives are concerned. But, we can't do everything, but we can certainly build a system by which someday we can seek accountability for what all of the warring parties, not just Assad, are doing to children.
Let's bring in Ted now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Ted.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So I was wondering, given that just a few days ago, Trump strongly stated that he wanted to pull us out of Syria, and then we have this attack, and all of a sudden he is raring to launch missiles back into Syria. I wonder that Assad is no fool, and Russia isn't stupid. So strategically, why would there be any justification for them to use chemical weapons? It seems like the only thing it gains is to create the reason for, you know, U.S. or Western military action. You know, on the heels of Trump saying that we were going to pull out, just seems very illogical if you think about it strategically. So I was just wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Ted, thanks.
No, very good point. Absolutely. Why do you use chemical weapons? There is no reason to use chemical weapons. It's absolutely prohibited. There's no actual military benefit when you are gassing civilians. It just doesn't, from a military point of view, from a political point of view, make any sense. And it actually causes the world to refocus on Syria. I don't understand why they did it, frankly, because now all of a sudden, if they'd have kept their powder dry, so to speak, Trump was showing indications that the U.S. was going to cede power to the Russians and tip the hat to Assad, saying you won and we were going to leave. But then they use chemical weapons. And what it is that despite the naivete of our president related to anything that deals with international law or international politics, he does get stirred up when he sees, and as we all should, frankly, when he sees children being gassed. And last year he did an appropriate response. It's related to the use of chemicals. It's a lawful act by a nation state to retaliate when a country uses a weapon of mass destruction like chemicals. And he appropriately destroyed the chemical ability at that time. So,
but apparently when the missile struck those planes, that airfield apparently was up and running 24 hours later.
Well, again, of course, but the actual act by him was an appropriate legal response. And so I don't understand why Syria and Russia decided to use chemicals again, unless they thought, well, Trump isn't going to do anything because he signaled I'm pulling out. And then Trump turned right around and said, wait a minute, that's too much, and he's coming right back in again. So they may have misjudged Trump and decided that if he's pulling out, we can go ahead and do whatever we want in Syria. But again, that's just my opinion. I don't have any insight on that. It was quite surprising to me when they used chemical weapons again. It didn't make sense either, so your point is well taken.
Let's go to Jerry now with a question in Lake Mills. Hi, Jerry.
We seem to have a short memory about these sarin gases. We used sarin gases in Iraq and in Fallujah, and we seem to have forgotten that, and no one was prosecuted. And it's my opinion that when we give people in power a pass to do these sorts of things, it just gives a green light to other despots to do the same.
Jerry, thanks. Your thoughts there, David.
If the implication is that the United States used chemical weapons in the war in Iraq, that is just not true. It just doesn't happen, and it did not happen that way. That's a violation of international law and something that the U.S. Has not done. We don't have a lot of evidence of the use of chemical weapons during the Iraq invasion in 2003. Even though it's not beyond them, but we don't have any real incidences of that.
And so when the Assad regime gets an order to destroy its chemical weapons, as it did from the Obama administration, how do we know that that happened and that there was the follow-up there, where he got them this time around?
Well, again, there is in fact, this is such an important issue at the international level. You know, the United Nations has an office that monitors weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, and they went in and verified that they were destroying their chemical weapons. I don't think it was all of them, but they were on the road to do so. So obviously they have gotten chemical weapons from outside sources, from Iran as well as Russia, which has still has, even though they're supposed to be destroying their chemical weapons, Russia still has a stockpile of those kinds of horror weapons that are being used in Syria.
David, as we wrap up with you, where can people learn more about the humanitarian crisis in Syria? What can they do a world away?
Well, that's a great question. And in 2012, I co-founded the I Am Syria campaign, which you can find on the web, IamSyria.com, where we do two things. One is to show people how to be activists in their in their local towns and cities, particularly high school students who would like to do something. And then we also provide lesson plans for high school teachers around the world on how to teach about Syria. And we're very proud of the fact that over 15,000 teachers from around the world have downloaded our lesson plans. That's IamSyria.com, and I think that you'll find that very instructive and give you some thought as to how one can talk about Syria and do something about Syria locally.
David, thank you so much for making time for us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate allowing to talk about Syria. We cannot let Syria fall off the kitchen table. We have to keep up the pressure. So thank you guys.
David Michael Crane created the Syrian Accountability Project, documenting crimes against humanity committed during the ongoing civil war in Syria. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Colleen Leahy, Keely Baltina, and Brianne Shasso. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson, executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.